It's the Abundance Paradox edition of Radio Free Thinker. For this week's Web Wisdom edition, we have A World Without Work, Poverty and Abundance, Rethinking Work, How Hot is Hot, and the Reality of First World Problems. Let's begin episode 321.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, we bring a set of Web Wisdom clips. Let's start with a theme about why, in a world of plenty, we still feel the need to work all the time, and why people still live in poverty. Let's start with a TED Talk by Nigel Cameron about A World Without Work.
I'd like to ask us a fundamental question this afternoon. Perhaps the most fundamental question which the human race confronts in the 21st century. The most fundamental question: will this be the century which is best known, which is marked, which is overshadowed by the triumph of technology? Or will it be the century which is marked by the triumph of humanity? Will we be able to frame these extraordinary developments in technology in such a way that they enhance, engage the flourishing of the human race? That seems to me the question of the 21st century. In fact, one could argue that it is the question of human history. Because throughout our history, we have been striving, toiling, working, laboring to create tools. Homo sapiens, wise man, the name of our species, is also Homo faber, the man who makes things. Humanity, who creates tools to enable us to do our work. And we can see the history of the human race as a history in which we are able to accomplish more and more and more through the leveraging of our human efforts by hand, by brain, using tools. And this 21st century, in the extraordinary experience of which we find ourselves, our generation, is the century in which there is no question that these tools will become very rapidly faster and faster, more pervasive, more enabling, more powerful, more open to abuse, more open to enabling the flourishing of our human species. So that seems to me to be the question we face this year and in each year of the 21st century. Now, the most evident way in which these technologies are beginning to affect us is a way which is very troubling, which could also be very hopeful. And I want to take you on to a journey into a future which I believe may not be beyond the lives of many in this room, in which we have a world without work, in which our tools have been developed so well that they do all of our work for us, in which artificial intelligence, robotics, has taken the load of human toil off the shoulders of the human species. And essentially, work, labor for money, which we have been schooled into believing is what we must do. Since we were hunter-gatherers and worked in this random way, we've moved toward an industrial society for which we are educated, for which we are prepared, in which we labor to pay our way. We face a future. I do not know how far ahead. I do not know how likely, but I think it is a significant possibility, and it's a significant possibility in our lifetimes in which work is no more. How do we frame this future? Is it a future which takes us to heaven on earth, in which we need not work? Or is it a future which takes us to hell on earth, in which we cannot work? I believe this to be a question which we should be taking far more seriously than we have been. Whether we as individuals, in our families, in our professional groups, in our societies, or whether we as those who influence governments and labor unions and investment policies and flows of capital in the global order. Because I think this is a question which is certainly as serious as things like the climate question, certainly as serious as things like the possible end of antibiotics. These are huge risk questions confronting the human community. We have to address them. Now, to reassure some of you and to worry others, these are not just questions coming from the radical left, who maybe are most critical of technology. Not questions coming from Luddites. Some of you will know the name of Ned Ludd. Britain, my former country, I now live in America, but Britain had the first industrial revolution. And gangs of men went around smashing equipment because they believed it would destroy their jobs. And of course they were right. And they were led by a man called Ned Ludd. So Luddism is the name we've given for smashing the technology because it will destroy jobs. Now, I'm not coming here to play the part of Ned Ludd. What is interesting, and this is really very new, in the last 2 or 3 years, we now see mainstream, centrist, responsible, boringly respectable people beginning to raise this question. So, for example, 2 MIT economists have published 2 books in the last 3 or 4 years raising these questions and seeing major losses of work because of robotics. The Financial Times had an article, London's boring financial newspaper, on this very question. A few months ago, perhaps the most comprehensive discussion, Oxford University has a centre called the Martin Institute. It's this futurist centre and includes, you know, transhumanists and all sorts of enthusiasts for the future. These are not in any way Luddites. They produce a fascinating report which argues that 47% of jobs in America in 20 years' time are likely to go. Now, of course, interesting number, 47%. Brazil is 47% of the landmass of Latin America. You all know the map of your country. Imagine that landmass removed. It's almost half the jobs in the US economy. They analyzed 702 different jobs. A detailed examination. That's what they think. Now, for example, look at the companies, just the samples of what's going on. I mean, look at the news the last 2 or 3 weeks. WhatsApp, bought by Facebook for $19 billion. Do you know how many employees WhatsApp has? It has 55. $19 billion in capital, 55 people with jobs. Huge value. Or to take perhaps an even more striking example, which connects us directly to the old economy, Instagram versus Kodak. Kodak, for 2 generations, dominated global photography. At its height, it had 145,000 employees in the company itself, plus all the distributors and photoshops. Instagram, there's some dispute as to exactly how many members of staff it has. It's around 11. I could not make this up. You can Google it while we are speaking. New kinds of value delivered in ways that involve hardly any human labor. So what I'm arguing is that we have a prospect here in which you are essentially removing the human factor, the labor factor, from the value equation. Capital, technology, deliver value. Humans are increasingly unnecessary. And you know the technologies which we're discussing. I have 3 quick examples to stick this in your head. Google cars, the G cars. California now is allowing these cars 500,000 miles driven, not one accident caused by the car. 2 accidents caused because the human driver got worried and took it over. Again, I'm not making that up. Far safer. Wired magazine recently argued this technology may begin with trucks. Because trucks, the cost base is far higher, they're much more dangerous. This is a far safer way to drive. You know, the Google cars, they have this thing spinning on the top. It spins 10 times a second. Every second, it absorbs more than 1 million data points. This is very sophisticated. Far safer. I don't know how many truck drivers there are in Brazil. In the United States, there are 5.3 million truck driving jobs. 10 years' time, 15 years' time, I suspect there will be zero truck driving jobs. I've actually tried to interest the U.S. labor unions, AFL-CIO, in having this conversation. I drew them into a conference which we had recently. They didn't seem particularly worried. I said, you know, the Teamsters may end up, the big truck drivers union, with no members. They didn't seem particularly worried. People think that the future will be so like the present. That's why the future is so risky. Second example, of course, we have IBM Watson. You know, IBM's supercomputer, which won Jeopardy, which made it the very famous, most famous computer in the world. They're now using IBM Watson for medical diagnosis. Diagnosis is what family doctors do. It's the main thing they do. They don't do it very well. Will there be family doctors seeing patients in 15 years' time when you can have a supercomputer and you can have a nurse or you can have a terminal taking your symptoms? Third example, of course, MOOCs. MOOCs, M-O-O-C, massive open online courses, these huge AI-based courses, which Stanford, MIT are offering, experimenting with these courses, in which the key thing is there's zero marginal cost. So basically, you can have 10 students in a class, or you can have a million students in a class. It doesn't cost any more. And one of our top experts on innovation has said he reckons in 10 years' time, 90% of American colleges may have closed. I think maybe he's pushing it a bit, but those are the dimensions. Incredible opportunities for global education in parts of the world where you will never get the kind of capital to establish major universities we have in the West. But not a lot of opportunities for people with PhDs. So, now the standard answer, of course, which some of you are already giving as you get cross with me, the standard answer to this argument is, but people like you have always been wrong in the past. The first industrial revolution since, every wave of invention, innovation, destroys large numbers of jobs and creates even more and creates far more wealth. It'll happen again. Well, I have to say, I regard that as industrial revolution fundamentalism. The notion it worked then, it worked, it'll always work, that is a very dangerous way to think. Two reasons. First of all, the pace of change. Moore's law, exponential curves. It's getting pretty steep. Ray Kurzweil was being quoted earlier. Genius of a man who believes the singularity will come in 2045 or something when the robot intelligence becomes smarter than us and takes over. I think he's wrong. But this guy is now head of engineering for Google. This is moving very fast. Now, secondly, we had this discussion recently at my think tank, and we had leading it off a man called Marshall Brain, who is a computer scientist who began a famous website, How Stuff Works, one of the early, very successful websites, which he sold years ago. Marshall Brain said, the problem with this argument is that, of course, this new revolution in technology will create a whole lot of new jobs. But who will do these jobs? Machines will do these jobs. That's the whole point. So, you know, Isaac Asimov, you know, had these famous three laws of robotics, or four, because he stuck one on the beginning and called it zero, which are basically all about robots being nice to people. They shouldn't harm people. It's a sort of wonderfully marvelous, liberal, sort of woozy idea. Now, of course, we have drone robots going around killing people. Somehow or other, Asimov, you know, his view has not been built into our technologies. But the point is, he did not add another law which said a robot will never take a job from a man or a woman who needs it. That is the question. So, how do we put these pieces together? I began by saying, this is the greatest question of our century. How do we frame this question? Is technology essentially tools to serve the human race, our humanity? Or ultimately, is technology the point? Are we meant to conform to technology? Is technology going to win? Is a technological model of what it means to be alive, to be thinking, to be active, is that really where we want to go? Are we basically just rather poor robots? We're rather poor computers. You want to get out of the wetware and just into the software and the hardware of this new world? Well, seems to me We invent the wheel. That's a tool. We invent the ads. Of course, in this country where you have primitive tribes still using very basic technology side by side with a highly advanced economy, you see this very clearly. These are just tools. We must frame them as tools. Tools to be used in the interests of the human community. It's how we frame these things, the context we place around them, the way we understand what it is that they're for. Now, as we begin to conclude, I have three questions to leave you with. One seems to me to be a really very, very evident. That is to say, we're talking here about highly advanced technologies and how we will operate when we have robots doing almost all of our work. I mean, they won't be novelists and poets and so on, but, you know, they will try to be, but that's not my point. We will not all get jobs as novelists and poets. Almost all of our work is doable by smart computing. Now, first question is, though, the existing technology we have, you know, we have these little smartphones, which, of course, are highly, highly powerful computers. We accidentally call them phones because occasionally we even use them as phones. We have these things. Now, how are they integrated into our social lives? To what extent do they enhance our humanity? To what extent are they turning us into machines who walk around bumping into people typing, and in the middle of a date people are pulling them out underneath the table in the bar? You know how it happens. I see them in the corridors, you know. These are wonderful things, and I use mine all the time, but how do we integrate them into our social purpose so they help the human race, so they are tools for us to use in order that we might flourish as human beings? It's a question for now. It's a question we should be much more worried about now. I think these tools are extraordinary. I wouldn't be here if I hadn't been chatting with Anna on Twitter 3 or 4 years ago. We've been chatting over the years. These tools are extraordinary. We must integrate them into our social, personal lives. Second question. Plainly, this prospect of heaven or hell, of a world without work, is a future prospect, but of course the future, you have to go to the future to make the decisions today and tomorrow. That's why this is so important. What are the impacts of this way of thinking? Even if it is just a 30% possibility in perhaps, you know, 40 years time, however you do the calculation, risk calculation there, as you do with climate, as you do with antibiotics, whatever the calculus is, how do we use that to affect decision making now in the policy community, in the corporate community, in our NGOs, among our industrial? Now, how should these reflections influence decisions taken today at the policy level? I think there are profound implications there, not least. We have an education system designed to turn us into industrial creatures, creatures for Fordism, for the factory system. We've loosened it up a bit. We talk about STEM all the time now. It's the same idea, training workers. Now, if when you get to be 22 and you leave college, you retire, what should you have been doing for the previous 17 years? Questions, of course, about income. Socialism says we should redistribute income. This isn't socialism. This is the good of the community from a completely different perspective. Income may have no direct relation to the work you do. Third question. This may be the most important question for you of the 21st century. We began with the question for the human race, now the question for you. If you never had to work again, if tomorrow morning and the next morning and the next morning you got up and there was no labor involved, and you could do essentially what you chose to do, what would you do? What would you do?
Let's follow it up with another TED Talk by Barry Schwartz about how the way we think about work is broken. Let's listen in.
Today I'm going to talk about work. And the question I want to ask and answer is this: why do we work? Why do we drag ourselves out of bed every morning instead of living our lives just filled with bouncing from one TED-like adventure to another? You may be asking yourselves that very question. Now, I know, of course, we have to make a living, but nobody in this room thinks that that's the answer to the question, why do we work? For folks in this room, the work we do is challenging, it's engaging, It's stimulating, it's meaningful, and if we're lucky, it might even be important. So we wouldn't work if we didn't get paid, but that's not why we do what we do. And in general, I think we think that material rewards are a pretty bad reason for doing the work that we do. When we say of somebody that he's in it for the money, we are not just being descriptive. Now, I think this is totally obvious, but the very obviousness of it raises what is for me an incredibly profound question. Why, if this is so obvious, why is it that for the overwhelming majority of people on the planet, the work they do has none of the characteristics that get us up and out of bed and off toward the office every morning? How is it that we allow the majority of people on the planet to do work that is monotonous, meaningless, and soul-deadening? Why is it that as capitalism developed, it created a mode of production of goods and services in which all the non-material satisfactions that might come from work were eliminated? Workers who do this kind of work, whether they do it in factories, in call centers, or in fulfillment warehouses, do it for pay. There's certainly no other earthly reason to do what they do except for pay. So the question is, why? And here's the answer. The answer is technology. Now, I know, yeah, technology, automation, screws people, blah, blah. That's not what I mean. I'm not talking about the kind of technology that has enveloped our lives and that people come to TED to hear about. I'm not talking about the technology of things, profound though that is. I'm talking about another technology. I'm talking about the technology of ideas. I call it idea technology. How clever of me. In addition to creating things, science creates ideas. Science creates ways of understanding. And in the social sciences, the ways of understanding that get created are ways of understanding ourselves, and they have an enormous influence on how we think, what we aspire to, and how we act. If you think your poverty is God's will, you pray. If you think your poverty is the result of your own inadequacy, you shrink into despair. And if you think your poverty is the result of oppression and domination, then you rise up in revolt. Whether your response to poverty is resignation or revolution depends on how you understand the sources of your poverty. This is the role that ideas play in shaping us as human beings, and this is why idea technology may be the most profoundly important technology that science gives us. And there's something special about idea technology that makes it different from the technology of things. With things, if the technology sucks, it just vanishes, right? Bad technology disappears. With ideas, false ideas about human beings will not go away if people believe that they're true. Because if people believe that they're true, they create ways of living and institutions that are consistent with these very false ideas. And that's how the Industrial Revolution created a factory system in which there was really nothing you could possibly get out of your day's work except for the pay at the end of the day. Because the father, one of the fathers of the Industrial Revolution, Adam Smith, was convinced that human beings were by their very natures lazy and wouldn't do anything unless you made it worth their while, and the way you made it worth their while was by incentivizing, by giving them rewards. That was the only reason anyone ever did anything. So we created a factory system consistent with that false view of human nature, but once that system of production was in place, there was really no other way for people to operate except in a way that was consistent with Adam Smith's vision. So the work example is merely an example of how false ideas can create a circumstance that ends up making them true. It is not true that you just can't get good help anymore. It is true that you can't get good help anymore when you give people work to do that is demeaning and soulless. And interestingly enough, Adam Smith, the same guy who gave us this incredible invention of mass production and division of labor, understood this. He said, of people who worked in assembly lines, of men who worked in assembly lines. He says he generally becomes as stupid as it is possible for a human being to become. Now, notice the word here is become. He generally becomes as stupid as it is possible for a human being to become. Whether he intended it or not, what Adam Smith was telling us there is that the very shape of the institution within which people work creates people who are fitted to the demands of that institution and deprives people of the opportunity to derive the kinds of satisfactions from their work that we take for granted. The thing about science, natural science, is that we can spin fantastic theories about the cosmos and have complete confidence that the cosmos is completely indifferent to our theories. It's going to work the same damn way no matter what theories we have about the cosmos. But we do have to worry about the theories we have of human nature, because human nature will be changed by the theories we have that are designed to explain and help us understand human beings. The distinguished anthropologist Clifford Geertz said years ago that human beings are the unfinished animals. And what he meant by that was that it is only human nature to have a human nature that is very much the product of the society in which people live. That human nature, that is to say, our human nature, is much more created than it is discovered. We design human nature by designing the institutions within which people live and work. And so you people, pretty much the closest I ever get to being with masters of the universe, you people should be asking yourself a question as you go back home to run your organizations. Just what kind of human nature do you want to help design?
And let's complete the theme with a talk by Dr. Roger Ray about the paradox of living in an age of abundance, and yet poverty seems to be everywhere. Let's listen and see what we can learn.
For most of human history, poverty was caused by scarcity. There simply was not enough food, not enough drinkable water, not enough housing. There was not enough seats in classrooms for everyone to receive a quality education, to be comfortably housed, to be adequately fed. But the past half century has changed that. For the first time in human history, the world has more than enough to provide all these things for everyone. What we have now is not a lack of resources. What we have now is a lack of morality, a lack of will, a lack of basic common decency. Our poverty, especially in the United States, is created by those who both hoard wealth and who cling to power. By the mid-1990s, this fact was being broadly discussed among both economists and agricultural specialists. There was no longer a need to focus on how to produce more food. We are already producing much more food than is being eaten, and in fact, more than could be eaten. We are subsidizing turning food into gasoline to find a way to get rid of it all while we're still surrounded by starvation. And when, arguably, there not only is not a shortage of gasoline, there is a glut of it. Thank you, Obama. I've been involved in poverty and hunger-related charities for most of my adult life. I've helped to build feeding centers in rural Nicaragua. I've cooked for our local homeless, and still every week I'm on the serving line, feeding as many homeless and hungry people as I can find. But I know that charity is not the answer. Charity is not a solution to poverty. And I don't want to diminish charity in any way. I don't want to slide it. I sent a gift to Nicaragua this week because I still really believe in what the Rainbow Network is doing there. And I'll be back at Bill's Place on Thursday serving lunch again this week, as I am every Thursday. But I know that these gestures are symbolic. You don't have to, you never have to explain that to me. I get it. It's like trying to put out a forest fire with a squirt gun. The problem is not that food is not available. The problem is that most people can't buy it. They can't get into the economic flow of people who get a regular pension or paycheck that let them go to the marketplace and buy what they need to eat and take it home and cook it the way they should be able to. As Dorothy Day was fond of saying, the problem is our stinking rotten system and our acceptance of it. Our ancient scriptures, our hymns, our cultural myths and stories all evolved in a context of food shortage, so that they derived images of generosity, of sharing, of showing charitable concern for those less fortunate. But all of those tender-hearted, well-intended images are not accurate in the 21st century. They are not accurate descriptions or reactions to what is going on in the economy of the present moment. I've seen Dickens' Christmas Carol maybe 100 times. I have personally played The Ghost of Christmas Present 3 times on stage. I still cry every time Scrooge has his epiphany at the end. I have cried watching the Mr. Magoo version of The Christmas Carol. But I'm telling you, charity is kind of a feel-good tipping in the face of the real problem. And the real problem is an economic system that keeps nearly half of the population locked into poverty when we have more than enough to take care of them. There are more empty, repossessed houses in the United States than there are homeless people. There are more empty houses than there are homeless people. There's more food going into the landfill every day than would be needed to feed every hungry person in the world. Our problem is not scarcity, unless what you mean by scarcity is a lack of conscience, a dearth, may I say, of giving a damn. That the system is so corrupt, and yet we have come to accept it as a necessity, that we forget to challenge it. Now, there's been conversation around for the last 50 years about paying a basic wage, not a minimum wage, not food stamps, not public housing, but paying a basic wage to every living human being. And if you just did it in the United States, you pay a minimum wage that is livable to everyone, and then if you want a better life, you work. And you try to start jobs, and you try to be creative. And if we did that, and this is mind-boggling, and I'm not an economist, and I don't want to go too far chasing this rabbit into the woods, but what it costs to administer our public housing, our food stamp program, our aid for mothers programs, if we simply took the bureaucratic costs out and paid everyone a basic wage, we would literally save money. Now, why wouldn't we do that? Because Americans are horrified of giving someone something for nothing. We are horrified by the concept. But where they've done it, like in Alaska, where there's been so much oil income in Alaska for years, that every Alaskan, whether you're a millionaire or a pauper, everyone gets a check every year. And it's not a basic wage, but it's a couple of $1,000s. And what they've discovered is that it multiplies in the economy, that you give everyone a couple of $1,000s, and you give a poor person a couple of $1,000s, they will not establish an offshore savings account to invest it in. They will spend it, and they will spend it in local stores, and they will spend it in housing, they will spend it on trading a car, and it stimulates the economy. In American Indian reservations, where their income has been large enough, they give a distribution to everyone, and they discover that it multiplies within the economy. It really makes a huge difference. A basic wage to all Americans would change everything. But somehow, we are suspicious. Now, is that a personal statement? I mean, if you got a barely subsistent amount of income, would you not work? Or might you be brave enough to start your own business, to do something genuinely adventuresome? If we had health care for everyone, like every other civilized nation in the world, and if we had a basic income, wouldn't that inspire you to work rather than taking away your incentive? It would keep you from getting captured in a dead-end job doing the same thing over. Then you would have the courage to go to school. Then you would have the courage to create new economies.
Let's take a moment for a breather and a break, and we'll return after this.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide.
I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy.
Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open my latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Conservation is the first and best resource option for BC. Do your part. Turn off the lights when you leave a room and unplug your cell phone charger when charging is complete. Visit bchydro.com to find out more ways you can make a difference. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, an overworked, poverty-based broadcast with an abundance of skepticism on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. And we're back. So let's shift gears a little with a clip from School of Life about first world problems may be more important than we tend to give them credit. So let's listen and learn.
We've grown used to belittling things that don't happen to be important to us right now with a powerful term, first world problem. So when your partner is moaning that their job's a bit boring, it's tempting to say that this is a first world problem, just as they might have told you that you had a first world problem when you complained that the shopping mall looks a bit ugly or that you don't like your in-laws. This kind of tough-minded response is understandable, but a bit counterproductive. Just because an issue isn't connected to life or death doesn't mean it doesn't cause genuine pain or isn't worth thinking about. A problem can be important without being life-threatening. Moreover, we should be excited by trying to solve the most advanced problems out there. The problems of rich countries are, for the most part, both complicated and serious. They're the ones that everyone is going to face in about 300 years' time. The issues that people have in Switzerland and Norway, Australia and the Netherlands, these are the problems that all humanity will have in about 2250. First world problems aren't an unnecessary oddity. They're a form of time travel. They're a glimpse into what we'll one day all have to worry about. There are currently 25 countries on this planet that qualify as first world. You probably live in one of them. In these rich countries, people don't starve, life expectancy is high, and child mortality is low. But there are a lot of other problems. Not sob stories of the well-to-do begging sympathy because the wine isn't properly chilled. They are central issues of philosophy and politics because every day we're fighting to get richer, and so we need to understand the problems that come with or undermine that struggle. You'd think people in the rich world felt they had enough material things. The average Australian is more blessed in material terms than the kings of medieval Europe ever were. But something very odd and troubling about human nature has come to light. It seems we don't decide whether we have enough by asking ourselves what we need or comparing our material possessions with those that our parents or grandparents had. And we certainly don't think of people in the poorest country in the world, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We ask whether we have enough by looking at other people around us, in the immediate vicinity, and especially people we see on TV. Our happiness is comparative and relative by nature. This sets up a devilish problem, because, driven by advertising, there's always more that we could have and that some other people around us already do. That's an enormous part of why rich countries are not as happy as they're supposed to be. In 1975, economist Richard Easterlin identified the average level of happiness in the US as 2.2 on a famous happiness scale that he devised. At that point, per capita GDP was $22,000. Now, GDP per capita in the US is $54,000. But extraordinarily, the happiness level is exactly the same, 2.2. It's a deeply shocking result, like going to the gym every day for years and discovering that you're no happier with your body than when you started. Wealth does matter to happiness, but only up to a point. Research suggests that every dollar you earn up to $20,000 per head makes you happier, but thereafter, you need a lot of other things to make you content. Rich countries are rich because their economies are enormously productive. Economists and manufacturers love productivity, but it's also responsible for one of the oddest and most pervasive causes of modern unhappiness, what we now call being stressed. The United States, the world's most productive economy, is also by far and away the most stressed place you could live in. We're buying our wealth at a very high price indeed. We work hard partly because we're afraid. Thanks to recessions, the rise of service jobs and rising global competition, the typical job tenure in the 20 richest countries is now only 15 months. No wonder we're stressed. Everything in rich countries becomes cheaper year by year, except for one thing which matters far more than TVs or mobile phones: your house. House inflation, averaged out across the capital cities of the rich countries, has been running at an annual rate of 20% per annum for the last two decades. This has had an enormous impact on everything, but one thing in particular: commuting times. Commuting is globally the least liked part of the working day, but we're doing ever more of it, because when a place is rich, the distances between work and affordable homes increases painfully and exponentially. In Ireland, you might spend 26 minutes a day commuting. In South Korea, it's a full 55 minutes. Insane commuting times is a small, incidental, but deeply telling symptom of a wealthy but very unhappy society. Partly as a result of stress and commuting, we are collectively exhausted. One-fifth of people in Japan suffer from insomnia. In the UK, 51% of the population believe they don't get enough sleep. Tiredness brings other issues. We get too tired to cook. In the UK, the huge pre-made meal industry is growing at 6% a year, which means that by 2037, every single meal consumed in the British Isles will, by current trends, have been made in a factory. We're too tired to read. On average, Americans spend 7 minutes a day reading for pleasure. 89% say they'd like that to be more if they weren't so tired. And we're too tired to exercise. 21.5 minutes a day is the recommended amount of exercise to keep oneself in shape. But that's beyond the reach of more than 80% of everyone in the top richest 20 countries. It doesn't help that we drink. In the UK, the average man will drink 1,100 pints of beer a year. Alcohol is the leading relaxant. We watch online porn. 42% of all downloads are pornographic. 10% of adults admit to internet porn addiction. However, these statistics don't capture the most significant aspect of the problem. 78% of users of porn say that they're very or highly disappointed by the quality of their real relationships. Relationships are crucial to happiness, but what's been discovered is the disastrous alignment of wealth creation and relationship troubles. Divorce rates are very high in rich countries. 53% in the USA, 55% in France, 60% in Luxembourg. And there's a huge hinterland of the unhappy undivorced. In the US, of people who stay together, 70% have seriously thought of leaving, but fear separation would be even worse. They're not necessarily wrong. One third of people in the US say they're very or desperately lonely. In France, 4 million people admit to having no real friends. Loneliness is a side effect of wealth creation. In poor countries, you can't easily survive on your own. As countries get richer, people move for work. The economic unit ceases to be the family. The workplace takes over. then the workplace lets you down. The rich world is far better at tearing up natural habitats and turning them into enormous, soulless, frighteningly ugly cities. At the moment, 3.5 billion people live in urban areas. It will be 6 billion by 2050. There will be nearly as much urban construction in the next 50 years as there has been in the whole of human history up till now. The quality of the environment is among the top three concerns of people in the rich countries. We're so good at complaining about our lack of income, we have as yet found no convincing, collective way of articulating how much beauty matters to us and how sad the omnipresent ugliness has made us. The things that make us unhappy in rich countries give us a poignant picture of unmet needs for relationships, meaning, beauty, and a sense of purpose. There's an enormous task ahead of us. The solutions are not primarily financial. They're about psychology and ideas. At present, we measure a lot of things, like the GDP, inflation, and unemployment. These are all attempts to get at what we really want to know. Are our lives getting better? But for all our expertise, we don't have big authoritative indices around the quality of relationships, national stress levels, the incidence of envy, the amount of hugs people give each other, the number of random acts of kindness. But this is what we need to be announced on the daily news to focus our collective efforts. We need indicators that measure our psychological rather than merely financial well-being. News industries make their money from frightening and exciting us. The news constantly makes us imagine a world more violent, more filled with disaster, more politically unstable than it really is, and at the same time more inhabited by talented, beautiful, smart and sexy people than it is. This provides a staggeringly poor starting point for grasping our own needs. We're likely to feel ourselves craving greater and greater degrees of protection and security and in need of much more money, excitement and stimulation. Better media would provide us with a more realistic starting point and so lessen the anxieties which we look to money to soothe. Traditionally, religion has had the function of giving authority and glamour to non-material values. If money and power were represented by a lion, then Christianity once saw itself as worshipping the meek and gentle lamb. Christianity told the mighty, the barons, the generals, the warlords, to be kind. It taught them to recognize the importance of spiritual values that otherwise would have had no currency. And through magnificent works of art, it preached the final superiority of the spiritual to the material. Today, we can't rely on organized religion to do this, though they continue to make the attempt. But the need remains. A good society needs to have people who celebrate money, but also just as many people ready to celebrate non-material things, like kindness, forgiveness, and the importance of going on country walks. We require a new system of education to promote psychological wisdom. If we work backwards from life, it's clear that schools fail all but a tiny portion of their students. Trouble around work and relationships remains very widespread indeed. We need to learn not just maths and history, but also, far more importantly, how to live and die well. The kinds of cities we live in has vast implications for the quality of our lives, but at present our collective aspirations are undeveloped. We need to construct tight, compact cities with the elegance of Edinburgh, San Francisco or Heidelberg, and somehow cap house prices to a level affordable by an average citizen. This is only the beginning of the list. What is clear is that trying to make societies ever richer isn't the answer. Given the standard of living in the rich countries, it isn't a lack of money that's the real problem. It is, broadly speaking, a lack of wisdom. And that's a challenge for all of us now.
Okay, shifting gears now a lot, and I added this in just to be sort of, you know, a fun thing. How hot can hot be? Let's hear Vsauce's take on this heated topic.
Hey, Vsauce. Michael here. And my tea is quite hot, but it's not the hottest thing in the universe. So what is? I mean, we know that there is an absolute zero, but is there an absolute hot? A point at which something is so hot it can't get any hotter? Well, to find out, let's begin with the human body. Your internal temperature is not constant. 37 degrees, 98.6, sure, but those are averages. Your body's internal temperature fluctuates by about 1 degree Fahrenheit, half a degree Celsius, throughout the day in a cycle. Assuming you sleep at night, at 4:30 in the morning, your body reaches its coolest natural healthy temperature. And at 7 p.m., it reaches its highest. But a dangerous fever is not good. 108 degrees Fahrenheit is almost always lethal. The highest recorded air temperature across all of Earth has happened four times in Death Valley, where it has reached 129 degrees Fahrenheit. 180 degrees Fahrenheit is the recommended temperature for water when brewing coffee, and at 210 degrees Fahrenheit, a cake is done. 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit is the temperature of lava fresh out of the ground. But come on, make your own lava like Green Science Pro. This guy uses Fresnel lenses to focus the sun's energy onto whatever he wants. This is a small piece of obsidian, volcanic glass, which he can melt into actual lava right in his backyard. Keep in mind that the sun is having that effect even though it is 93 million miles away from Earth. Right up on the surface of the sun is a different story. The surface clocks in at 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, but the center, where fusion occurs, is ridiculous. Temperatures there reach 28 million degrees Fahrenheit, which is also known as 15 million Kelvin. The Kelvin scale has units that are the same size as a Celsius degree, but it's an absolute scale, where zero is absolute zero. When matter reaches temperatures as high as those found in the center of the sun, an enormous amount of energy is radiated away. If you were to heat only the head of a pin to the temperature of the center of the sun, it would kill any person within 1,000 miles of it. Speaking of which, the energy emitted by an object often tells us a lot about the temperature of that object. Any object over absolute zero emits some form of electromagnetic radiation. You and me, we don't glow visibly, but we do emit infrared light. We can't see it, but infrared cameras can. WBD has great videos, and here he is hiding inside an opaque black trash bag. Now, we can't see him, but his body is infraredly glowing through it. If you want something to be the right temperature to glow in the visible spectrum, you'll have to reach the Draper point, about 798 Kelvin. At this point, almost any object will begin to glow a dim red. We can calculate the expected wavelength of radiation coming off of an object because of its temperature, and that wavelength gets smaller and smaller the hotter and hotter the object gets. It goes from radio waves to microwaves, up through infrared to visible, all the way to X-rays and gamma rays, which are created in the middle of our sun. At temperatures as hot as the sun, matter exists in a fourth state, not solid, not liquid, not gas, but instead a state where the electrons wander away from the nuclei, plasma. If you've watched my temperature lean back, you know that you can make plasma by microwaving fire. But don't do it. Besides, our sun isn't even close to being the hottest thing in the universe. I mean, sure, 15 million Kelvin is pretty incredible, but the peak temperature reached during a thermonuclear explosion is 350 million Kelvin, which hardly counts because the temperature is achieved so briefly. But inside the core of a star, eight times larger than our sun, on the last day of its life, as it collapses in on itself, you would reach a temperature of 3 billion Kelvin. Or if you want to be cool, 3 gigakelvin. But let's get hotter. At 1 terakelvin, things get weird. Remember that plasma we were talking about that the sun is made of? Well, at 1 terakelvin, the electrons aren't the only thing that wander away. The hadrons themselves, the protons and neutrons in the nucleus, melt into quarks and gluons, a sort of soup. But how hot is a terakelvin? Frighteningly hot. There's a star named WR104, about 8,000 light years away from us. Its mass is the equivalent of 25 of our suns. And when it dies, when it collapses, its internal temperature will be so great that the energy emitted, the gamma radiation it flings out into space, will be stronger than the entire amount of energy our sun will ever create in its entire lifetime. Gamma ray bursts are quite narrow, so Earth is most likely safe. But what if it wasn't? Well, when WR-104 collapses, even though Earth is 4,702 trillion miles away, the energy it releases would still be bad news. Exposure for 10 seconds would mean losing a quarter of Earth's ozone layer, resulting in mass extinction, food chain depletion, and starvation from 8,000 light years away. Closer to home, right here on Earth in Switzerland, scientists have been able to smash protons into nuclei, resulting in temperatures much larger than 1 terakelvin. They've been able to reach the 2 to 13 exakelvin range. But we are okay because those temperatures last for an incredibly brief moment and only involve a small number of particles. Remember how we could calculate the wavelength of the radiation emitted by an object based on its temperature? Well, if an object were to reach a temperature of 1.41 times 10 to the 32 Kelvin, the radiation it would emit would have a wavelength of 1.616 times 10 to the negative 26th nanometers, which is tiny. Like, so tiny, it actually has a special name. It is the Planck distance, which according to quantum mechanics is the shortest distance possible in our universe. Okay, well, what if we added even more energy? Wouldn't the wavelength get smaller? It's supposed to, but yet it can't. This is where we've got a problem. Above 1.41 times 10 to the 32 Kelvin, the Planck temperature, our theories don't work. The object would become hotter than temperature. It would be so hot that what it is would not be considered a temperature. Theoretically, there is no limit to the amount of energy we could keep adding into the system. We just don't know what would happen if it got hotter than the Planck temperature. Classically, you could argue that that much energy in one place would instantly cause a black hole to form. And a black hole formed from energy has a special name, a Kugelblitz. So basically what I'm trying to say is when you want to tell someone you like that you think they are hot, so hot that not even science can understand it, just call them a Kugelblitz. Finally, here is something fun. The sun is about 4.7 billion years old, about halfway through its life cycle. And so far, it has burned 100 Earth's worth of fuel, which sounds like a lot, but the sun is the size of 300,000 Earths. Because of that discrepancy, you can have a lot of mathematical fun comparing your energy output to the sun's. The sun is way hotter than us, and it puts out way more energy than us. Bad astronomy had a lot of fun with this one, and although it doesn't really mean anything, it is technically true, because of the sun's enormous size, that 1 cubic centimeter of human puts out more energy than an average cubic centimeter of the sun. Which should make you feel quite warm inside.
And that's about all the time we have this week. Brace yourself for a set of 2015 Year in Review shows with some special guests. And on that note, Happy New Year's all, and this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.